Because their banking accounts are so secretive, once I've got their account number and password, I can make non-reversible transactions in total anonymity. I'm about to drain every one of their private accounts and send the cash to the nonprofits who will never know where the money came from. On the other hand, when the bad guys check their accounts, they'll find them empty, with no transaction record as to where the money went. Nice little feature of offshore bank accounts, no history tapes. He hits a few keys. On the screen, arrow lines begin to flash from the bank accounts to the charitable organizations. Those are the transfers taking place. Watch. After a while, the bank account dots will vanish. When a dot disappears, the account is empty, says David. Soon all the bank accounts are gone, and only the charitable organization's stars remain. Well, wasn't that fun, says David. Holy shit, man, that was unbelievable. You really did it, shrieks Mike. They're out of business, adds Jay. Well, they'll regroup eventually, I'm sure. But for the time being, they're in trouble. Serious trouble. They'll be late with their payments to a lot of cops and politicians this month. Could have serious repercussions, says Jay. This should nuke them pretty well. I wonder if they'll trace it back to Jack's little problem. Oh, they will. I'm sure of that, says Todd. Before we screwed up their email, I sent everyone a little picture postcard JPEG of Omaha with the caption, "Weather sucks. Wish you were here." Signed Jack. Should be a real hit, and I do mean a real hit. There's going to be a lot of unhappy people when they check their balances tomorrow, says Todd. Yes, and a lot of happy charities, too. Any idea how much money got transferred, says Lance? A couple of billion, I guess, more or less. I'll have a full total in a day or two when all the transactions clear. Okay, one more trick, says Todd. I'm sending, anonymously, to Customs, the DEA, FBI, the cable news networks, the wire services, schedule of all large shipments of dope into the U.S. for the next month, including port of entry, means, amount, couriers, carrier, etc., and also a schedule of large cash shipments going out of the country for the next few weeks. This should mess up their supply network. Wow, the last straw, says Jay. More like the last joint for a lot of places, says Mike, looking over the manifest on the display screen. And now, anyone for lunch, says Todd. Chapter 14. Sunday, January 21, time, 2 p.m. Sunday afternoon around 2 p.m., Todd pages David, Lance, Mike, and Jay and asks them to meet him in the command center. They arrive, grab some coffee, and sit down as they were the day before. So what nefarious plot have you cooked up to make their day even worse, says Jay. Well, Jay, I'm glad you asked. I've been going through all this data that our little rootkits have been sending. Seems there's a real gallery of JPEGs there. Nice family photo album, it would so appear. And I sorted through the pictures and extracted the finest mugshots of all the major players. Then I hacked the computers of several big city dairy companies. Dairies? You mean milk companies? Yeah. Starting tomorrow morning, milk cartons all over the country will feature pictures of drug lords with appropriate caption, name, and address. Milk cartons? Yeah, with the DEA phone number on each to call if you spot the subject. Jack is not going to be amused, says David. Hey, but I will, says Todd. Well, me too, says Mike. Chapter 15, Monday, January 22, time, noon. By Monday, chaos rules the drug underworld. Unencrypted messages are flying back and forth, expressing total confusion and fear. The milk cartons have begun to appear in larger cities. The local police are both amused and embarrassed. Politicians who only days before are on the take are obstreperously demanding investigations as their payments dwindle. Several drug lords flee the country for safer havens in South America. Jack is holed up in his apartment in St. Louis, desperately trying to establish connections with his former colleagues. Monday, a little after noon, Todd and David decide to drive to an electronic parts supplier to buy some gear. Todd's got some ideas for a new stealth computer-controlled robotic camera, and he and David are going to build a prototype. They head to downtown Omaha, preoccupied and arguing most of the way over how the system should be built. They park the car in the lot behind the store, slam the doors, and stomp up the alley, still arguing. Inside, they quiet down as they troll through the aisles of electronic hardware, picking out parts, sockets, chips, amps, Gatorades, and other toys. Once back outside, the argument resumes, where they pretty much repeat themselves, as usual. As they turn the corner and start back down the alley towards the parking lot, it's blocked by a large van. Four guys suddenly surround them, two from behind and another two who jump from the van. Three have guns drawn. David and Todd immediately recognize them as the four erstwhile killers they last saw at the garage. They quickly tie Todd and David's hands behind their backs and shove them to the van, where they push them into the second row of seats. One kidnapper gets in the driver's seat, one gets in next to David, and the other two climb in the third row of seats. The van pulls out of the alley and heads for the interstate and the bridge over to Iowa. Once in Council Bluffs, they make for an old, secluded wooden farmhouse at the edge of town. They pull down a gravel driveway into a trashy backyard. On one side is an old car repair shop. On the other, the back of a drugstore. The far end of the yard ends in a cornfield. Two old snow-covered rusted cars are on the side. They drag Todd and David out of the van and up some worn unpainted wooden stairs and into a side door. The house is about 80 years old. Once an imposing structure for this part of the country, it served as the residence for the family that owned the farmland around it. Now it's just an old dilapidated eyesore, unpainted and slowly falling down on the outskirts of town. The interior is mostly trashed as the present occupants are not fussy about appearances. The side door leads to an old kitchen. The walls are faded wallpaper, peeling in places. An old gas stove and rust-stained sink are along one wall, a refrigerator against the other. Dirty dishes, pots, glasses, empty cardboard pizza boxes litter every surface in the room. An old table sits in the middle, surrounded by four old wooden straight-backed chairs. The floor is scarred, stained yellow linoleum with burn marks from many dropped cigarettes. They prod David and Todd down the dark central hall towards the sitting room in the front of the house. The room is a collection of reject furniture covered in bedspreads over exposed springs and frayed upholstery. One of the abductors, Nick, the one Lance took on, points to a beat-up old sofa with his gun and says, "Sit down." David and Todd sit. The old couch sags under their weight. David says, "I guess we caught you on your maid's day off." "Shut your trap, Shay. We're doing the talking now," says one of them in reply. Nick says to the others with swagger, "Well, I guess we got them back, eh, guys?" They flop onto a motley collection of old chairs and couches, prop their scuffed boots up on old tables, light cigarettes, and compliment themselves on their great good luck. "I knew if we waited long enough we'd get a shot at them, man," says Roger nervously as he gulps beer from the can too fast. A rivulet trickles down his neck. "So what do we do next?" asks Bill. "You call that guy in St. Louis and tell him what we've got." "That's what," says Nick. "You know his phone number or how to get in touch with him?" "Joe used to talk about him, but he never gave any details," says Bill. "I got the number. It's his landline, too, so it'll work. Not like all those damn cell phones. I saw it written on a piece of paper on Joe's desk once. Thought it might be useful someday, so I wrote it down," says Nick. "I guess he'll be okay with this," asks Roger. "Okay? He'll be fucking delirious, man. We got the goods. These are the guys that fucked him." "Oh, yeah. He'll be okay with this," says Nick loudly. "I'll call him now. You'll see." Nick pulls out a slip of paper and picks up the phone. He carefully dials the number. Jack's landline phone rings. He picks it up and looks at the caller ID display. He doesn't recognize the incoming number, but the caller ID says it's from Northwest Iowa, so he takes a chance. After a few rings, Nick and Council Bluffs hears, "Yeah, what is it?" "My name's Nick. I used to work for Joe. I got this number from him before things happen. There's four of us here. We all used to work for Joe. We've got something you might be interested in." "Go on," says Jack. "I'm listening." "We got a certain bar owner from Omaha and his chief bartender as our guest, so to speak. Thought you might be interested," says Nick. "I don't want to talk on this line. Hang up. I'll call you back," says Jack cautiously, but to himself, thinking, "Holy shit, mother fucking load." They hang up, and Jack takes out a fresh prepaid phone. He's had to buy several of these since the communications breakdown a few days earlier. For some reason, as soon as he begins using a new one, it stops working a few hours later. He dials the number in Council Buffs that appeared on the caller ID. Nick answers, and Jack says, "Okay, go ahead. I'm listening. What's your connection to all this?" "You were the guys Joe sent to the club a week and a half ago to take care of that Mike guy. He got ambushed by Shay and his people and left out on the interstate. I'm the one with the broken jaw. You probably saw me on TV. Half the fucking country saw us on TV in our underpants. You know the story." "Yeah, I know the story. Buy some better underwear or stop getting dumped at rest stops with TV cameras." "Well, when Joe's warehouse went bang, we figured this Shay guy might not be so careful, seeing as how he pretty much shut the business down around here. You know what I mean? We figured this might be our chance to even the score. How'd you do it?" "We just watched and waited around the club until we saw the two of them drive off today around noon. We followed them to a store downtown. When they came out, as they went down an alley to get to their car, we nabbed them. Simple, really." "Well, this is interesting. So, what do you want us to do with them?" "We were thinking a swim in the river with a few weights attached." "No, don't do that. I'd like to meet Mr. Shay and his friend. I'd be very interested in meeting them. Do you know the old farmhouse in Iowa where we keep supplies and collect the goods?" "Yeah, it's about 60 miles from here, just west of Fontenelle. Out in the middle of fucking nowhere," says Nick. "Good, Jack thinks. Now he knows these guys are legit. Not many people know about that particular farm. Bring them there and wait for me. I'll be on the next plane to Des Moines and I'll head out there. It's about 60 miles from Des Moines. I should be able to get there by about 6 or 7 tonight. You got that?" "Yeah, boss. We got that. No problem." "Great. Good work, guys. Very good work. Last something goes right up there. I'll call you back in a few minutes once I make some reservations," says Jack. In Council Bluffs, Nick hangs up the phone and looks at his three roommates and says, "We're going to deliver them to the farm near Fontenelle. Jack's going to meet us there." "How do you sound?" asked Roger. Roger. Happy. Real happy. We're going to have jobs again real soon. So let's pack up and load the van. He said he'd call back in a few minutes once he got some travel arrangements. Jack quickly gets on a travel website and finds a commuter flight to Des Moines. It's 2 o'clock and the next flight leaves at 3:30 p.m. He can make it. He buys an e-ticket and prints out the boarding pass. He grabs his coat, wallet, and his prepaid cell phone. He rushes out the door for Lambert Field. The phone in Council Bluffs rings as Jack calls back. This is Jack. Okay, I got the tickets. I'll be there around 7 p.m. I'll rent an SUV and drive over. Be sure you get some food and booze on your way out there, says Jack. See you at the farm, says Nick, and hangs up. Nick looks to David and Todd, points his gun in their direction, and says, okay, you two, time for a little road trip. They pile back into the van that once belonged to Joe. They pull out of the driveway and onto Highway 92 East.